Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Robert Stivers is speaking on Christian ethical issues, violence. So let's listen in on Robert Stivers.
For a number of years, I have been using case studies as a way of teaching. I believe that anchoring religion and theology in the actual lives of people is an important way to teach, and I have taught that way as a methodology for many, many years. The book you will find has my name on it. I organized this project, and it's now in the second edition. One of you has an orange-colored book, which is the new edition that's coming out just like this month. The rest of you have a blue edition, which is the old edition. It doesn't make any difference. About 60% of the cases are the same, including this one. There's the orange book. These books will, I understand, be available at the bookstore sometime if you want to purchase them. If you want to just use the 10 I brought along, that's quite all right as well. I will be using these case studies again tomorrow and Friday if you're interested. Perhaps what I should do is leave them in the library, in the section of the library here, and you can come and pick them up there. I'll leave them in this box here and set them in someplace in there and talk to Randy about that.
When are your classes tomorrow?
I think tomorrow afternoon, late afternoon, and then Friday morning. Tomorrow's topic will be the question of abortion. It's a case study in here called Mary Gardner about a woman who is in her mid-30s, facing a fourth pregnancy unexpectedly, and whether to get an abortion. It raises the personal ethical issue of abortion, but within that, the larger social questions obviously arise. And on Friday, there's a case in the book called More Light, which deals with a Presbyterian congregation dealing with the question of whether they should ordain should subscribe to a set of principles called the More Light, become a More Light church, which allows no discrimination on the basis of race, sex, sexual orientation, etc., etc. And that's been a very divisive issue in the church. Today the issue is the issue of violence, and the case is a case entitled Vietnam's Children. One of the advantages, as I just said, of having an older, what I would call an older group, I now class myself in that older category, is that we all are familiar with the Vietnam struggle and probably have some ideas on that. Usually when I have students in college, I don't have that luxury, and we have to go back and try to tell them or lecture or to discuss or to have videos on what the nature of the Vietnam struggle was. Cases have been used in religious education for 20, 25, 30 years now. And as I said, I enjoyed this method. Without saying anything more, let's get started on the case. Who are the characters in the case? Can someone, and this, we'll do this by discussion. I am a teacher, and I know where I want to go with this case. So I'm not this is not just an open discussion going anywhere at once, but I will ask questions, if you please. But let me ask the first question. Maybe someone would volunteer. What's going on in the situation? Who could summarize the situation? Who are the main characters?
First was someone in a plane directed to bomb the Vietnamese
fighter. I can't hear you.
Sorry.
And that one, he said that there was, the case started out with the father recalling his own experience in Vietnam. The father's name was?
Couldn't tell you.
Martin Paxton.
There it is.
Okay, and then what occurs to happens in the, as the plot thickens, so to speak. Anybody?
Well, his son has to register for the draft.
His son is 18 years old, and as you know, at 18, you've all probably had children that have gone through this. You go down to the post office, and what happens today? You register for the draft. We could go through what the draft involves today. Basically, your name goes into a computer, but there is a system in place whereby, with an act of Congress signed by the president, which would, in times of war would be very quick, under a great deal of wartime hoopla, you could be called for a physical within about 10 days. So in a very short period of time, some of my students don't realize, the males in particular, that in a very short time they could be down on the in basic training. So his son comes in, and the father says to the son, or what exchange occurred?
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, what are you going to do about the draft? And his son says, what?
Going to practice basketball.
Yeah, I want to be a
conscientious
objector.
Yeah, he's going to sign up and be conscientious.
Yeah.
He was going to register.
Yeah, he just, but he didn't particularly know what that meant. And he just dribbled the basketball off. And the father does what? Sits and recalls a class session that he has had in which a number of perspectives on violence have been presented by various people who visited the class, Christian perspective. And those people, so Chris is the son, Chris Paxton, can you see that back here with these wedgy markers that don't work? The three people who make presentations are Jacob, Ronald, who makes two, and Maria. The first of these is Jacob Kaufman. Who is Jacob?
Amish.
Who are the Amish? Do you know?
They are nonviolent people.
Nonviolent people. Do you know what they're, where they come from?
Germany.
They started in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Arabia. Or
yeah, this is the left. What's called the left wing of the Reformation,
yeah.
And the peace churches. Mm-hmm. The Amish are the real extreme. They won't even defend themselves in courts. Mennonites are less, and Quakers are less still. Generally speaking, these are churches with a pacifist orientation. What is pacifism?
Peaceful existence.
They don't believe in killing. I don't know how you put that.
They don't believe in killing.
People.
Sometimes animals, too.
Yeah.
Why don't they believe in, and of course, with regard to interstate warfare, what do they feel? What is their perspective?
Well, they still don't. They still feel that they mustn't
kill. Mm-hmm. So war is out of the question. Yeah. Why do they believe this? What's the Christian underpinning of this perspective? What?
Ten commandments, so you shall not kill.
Thou shall not kill. Do you know what the Jews meant by thou shalt not kill, however?
Mm-hmm.
No. They meant murder. And the Jews always allowed for justified killing. The Amish and the peace churches have always interpreted thou shalt not kill, however, like you have. Though the ancient Hebrews did not so interpret it. They allowed for justifiable killing.
Is this to justify the warfare in the ancient...
Yes,
oh, yeah,
yes, of course. Yeah. Oh yes, they fought. And that's another story too, because there's several traditions in the Jewish tradition on this, and the Hebrew tradition, the Old Testament perspectives. But I'm getting at the Amish now, and what is there? You say, thou shalt not kill. There has been, from the beginning of the...
Turn the other cheek.
Turn the other cheek. What are you referring to with that?
Jesus.
When someone hits you on the one cheek, you turn the other. That's found in the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain. And some people in the peace churches take those as commands. Mm-hmm. So they see them as commandments, that killing is decreed by God, violence is decreed by God to be out, that one suffers before one suffers. I think there's other underpinnings to the perspective. I think that probably this kind of command obedience things probably is insufficient from a religious perspective, and I think most Amish and peace church people have a deeper sense of why they are nonviolent. Do you know why? Why are, maybe some of you are nonviolent or are pacifist. Anyone here a pacifist? Well, why else would that might they be pacifist, the peace church people?
Don't they just take Christ's life as the example?
Christ's life is the example.
The cross, mm-hmm. If you're a true follower of Christ, or if you really have Christ in your heart, that loving your response.
Pick up your cross and follow me. And Jesus' life was one of nonviolence. Though there are a few hints that maybe Jesus condoned things other than nonviolence. For example, do you know any of those?
In the temple.
He pushed out the money changers, and John, it says he used a whip of cords, but it didn't say he hit anybody. There are a number of places in the Old and New Testament which suggest, I want to use the word suggest because I think they're hardly definitive with regard to Jesus and violence. I think the overwhelming model is one of nonviolence. And these people took that seriously, and the call to follow Jesus, the way called the way of the cross. Indeed, I think that's the key to it, to the pacifist position, is that they see the position underpinned by a religious faith perspective, which we might call the way of the cross, which includes, certainly as one of its major tenets, nonviolence. That one suffers before one inflicts suffering, that one is not called to get results, is not to make things come out right, but is called first to follow Jesus, and the following means to be a nonviolent person in everything you do. And I think that the underlying that is an understanding of faith, that when one receives the love of God in one's being through whatever spiritual means one receives that, that the automatic response is one of love towards neighbor, even the neighbor who is your enemy. I mean, the pacifist position, which is one which is time-honored. By the way, it was the first perspective. The early church was pacifist, and until the 3rd century, at least, you couldn't be a Christian without being a pacifist, though there were some exceptions, as the roles of the Roman army indicated, with Christian names. But generally speaking, pacifism was the early mark of the church. What do you think of pacifism? Think it's the way Christians should operate?
We use the word pacifist to express some sort of complacence.
Of what? Express what?
Some sort of complacence. That's not right.
Complacence? Uh-huh. Yeah.
How's that work? I'm not sure I understand.
But being complacent is not being pacifist.
Just letting things be. Is that what you mean? If you're complacent, you just...
Yes, some people would say that, but the active pacifists, like some of the peace churches, see themselves working very actively in society, but not violently. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of pacifism which is what am I looking for?
Passiveness,
that is, not assertiveness, that you're a pincushion for everyone that wants to hit on you. No, that's not what the peace churches have maintained as their perspective. It's a very assertive nonviolence. Jesus was not a passive person, but a very active person. Not many of you raised your hand when I asked if any of you are pacifists. Why aren't you a pacifist?
I haven't done anything to show it.
Don't show it.
Yeah, that's sort of my feeling too.
How's that?
I'm not acting upon my pacifism.
Okay. Are you violent all the time then?
No, I'm just non-active.
Non-active pacifist, all right.
Remember, I live in this country, and this country has certain principles that you follow, and that you as a citizen are obliged to follow.
Even though your allegiance to God is first, you know, render under Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but then it follows unto God the things that are God. And of course, for the pacifist, that allegiance means nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And that takes precedence over your allegiance. But you're saying the allegiance to the country, I'm putting words in your mouth, I'm sorry. I've said yeah, but you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
Well, what do you think?
With somebody like Saddam Hussein, you can't be a pacifist.
Well, the peace church people do. I'm going to be the devil's advocate here and say, yeah, peace churches say, yes, you do.
Then you what?
You let Saddam Hussein do his thing.
No, that's not right.
Well, the pacifist says it is. because you're called to follow Jesus.
The general thing of the sojourners, are they, that's pacifism, or is that realist?
I think that most sojourners, people who are part of that movement, are active pacifists.
Active pacifists. Okay.
I was intrigued by the book. It called it ethically rigorous. The most ethical rigor was within that context.
It is, in some ways.
And when you get into the realist, the next step, you start with criteria, and you start, it seems like you work circles around making violence okay.
Mm-hmm. And this one is kind of clear and nice. It,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Kind of hard, though, if someone comes up and hits you in the face to turn the other cheek. That's why it's so rigorous. It's really.
Yeah, I was impressed with that. You need, you're called to suffer before you inflict suffering.
Right. And that's what the position says. And that's the first position of the early church, the one closest to Jesus. And yet few of us are pacifists.
Do you equate pacifism? I mean, it seems to me that there's more than one level. Pacifism, when you're up against a war,
mm-hmm.
has some ethical aspects to it that just kicking your neighbor doesn't have.
Mm-hmm. There are, actually, pacifism is a continuum from very strict mm-hmm. pacifists who believe that even verbal assertiveness is too much. That is, there's psychological violence as well, and one doesn't inflict that. One doesn't raise your hand in the face of an aggressor. To those people who are perhaps nuclear pacifists, who would, don't see the, any problem with conventional warfare, but would be against any kind of nuclear use of nuclear arms. So pacifism isn't an extremely well-defined perspective, but goes over a continuum. But I'm trying to make it into a type here so that we can see it and see some of its dimensions.
There were the two types, of course, of I mean, there was the Christian realist.
Okay, let's get into that. That's the.
I think that may be what I.
This is the first position, first of two positions presented by Ronald Smith, which, and these are all, by the way, positions with long traditions in Christian thought and action. Now, the realist position, Christian realist position, says what?
There are such things as justifiable war.
War. Why? What's the Christian faith perspective that underlies that?
This is the problem is that, you know, it's so hard to know.
Uh-huh.
And who says.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is oppression that is just, there's no way to stop it except to kill the people who are doing it, or to, you know, if you've tried everything up to that point and nothing is happening, then it's all right to go and have a war. But it has to be justified by Christian ethics.
By certain criteria.
By some criteria.
Who establishes?
The criteria, as they've established in the tradition, are called the just war or the justifiable war conditions, and they're seven in number. Your objective must be peace. Last resort, you must have tried everything else. Just cause, war must be waged just, and so forth and so on. All these criteria supposedly have to be met. Now, the way that developed over the centuries was in the 3rd century, with the Emperor Constantine all of a sudden becoming Christian, or at least the emperors after him became Christian, all of a sudden the church became the established church of the empire and became financially supported by the empire, which meant pacifism was a kind of tough position to hold. You can imagine if you're getting supported by the emperor and you say the emperor shouldn't wage war, the emperor's probably not going to hang on to you very long. So the church changed its perspective, and within a century, Augustine articulated several of the principles, which he had picked up from classical Greek and Roman thought. And over the centuries, with other thinkers, the principles have emerged as the criteria for determining whether a war is justifiable or not. So now there's two things. you mentioned one of the things, one of the theological religious understandings of why one is a realist in these just war criteria are that some people want to
help others.
Well, some people want not to help other people.
Oh, so, you know,
human sin persists. Yeah. This is a perspective which says that even though Jesus has come into the world, human sin persists. And that while stopping an oppressor or someone who is being violent is not particularly good, when you use violence, it's better than letting that violence go on. So it presupposes, on the one hand, sin. It has a healthy understanding of human sin. That is, it's realistic. Understand that. On the other side of it, it's Christian, which says that, and it's, see, it's basically Christian realism is an effort to straddle the two worlds, the world to come or the world that Jesus articulated and the world that we still live in. And one foot is in the sin of this world, the other foot is in what Jesus says. So there's a Christian aspect which still says that violence is bad, and you better be careful when you advocate violence. And they want to hem it in with very strict criteria so that you stop all the violence. Because obviously if you condone violence, that's the barn door so big that even Adolf Hitler could get through that. Indeed, Adolf Hitler claimed that his war was just as well. And one of the problems with the just war tradition, when you once open the door, maybe all the cows walk out of the barn claiming that their side is justifiable. But anyway, the position is one is to be Christian, to follow those more passive dictates of Jesus, and the call of faith to love your neighbor. That is to say, there is a Christian aspect which motivates you to nonviolence. Nonviolence still is the norm, okay? Mm-hmm. But there may be occasions when things are really nasty, brutish, and short in Hobbesian language again, when conditions are met where violence is not good, but it's justifiable, just war. It's a justice. Another way of putting it is that sometimes the norms of nonviolence and justice, the guidelines from the tradition to be just, on the other hand, to be nonviolent, aren't compatible in certain situations. They conflict. And the question is, which are you going to choose? To do justice, to stop an oppressor, or to be nonviolent? And some people choose always to be nonviolent pacifist, and others choose sometimes to be one, sometimes to be other, depending on the situation. Is that clear? There's a third perspective articulated again by Ronald Smith, which is what? We have so far now the pacifism as a Christian tradition, Christian realism, or the just war tradition. We can put that probably better known as just war tradition. And third is what?
He mentions liberation theology.
Yeah, that's well, let's go to that. And let me come back to that. Maria, in the case, articulates something called liberation theology, which I want to get back to in a minute. But let's get the three long traditional perspectives on this, on the Jewish and Christian traditions.
The Crusades. Right.
Ronald also presents that because he couldn't find anyone to articulate. What's a crusade? And what's the tradition in Christianity? Say again?
Religious reasons.
For religious reasons. Mm-hmm. Where is biblical support found for that? Do you know?
In the Old Testament.
Old Testament, where? Do you know?
Pinpoint it for you.
Well, look in the books of Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges in particular, when the Israelites had come into the promised land and were fighting the Canaanites who inhabited the land.
David had a few problems.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What are some of the thinking behind the crusade?
He
get rid of the non-believers, you've got
That's right.
a lot of good believers.
It divides people into two groups, the believers and the non-believers, the good guys and the bad guys. And the bad guys are evil, and the good guys are good. And what does God command?
That the good guys get the bad guys
out. Yeah, you get rid of evil. And God commands that you get rid of evil. And in some places in the Old Testament, it has God commanding the Israelites to raise the whole town and kill everybody in it, burn it down as a as an offering to Yahweh.
Yeah.
Another place in Deuteronomy has Yahweh standing with his blood red, with his sword red with blood. I mean, it's a very what do I call it? A violent tradition. So the good guys and the bad guys, God commands it. Over the years, by the way, there has been a lot of crusades. Do you know of some of the crusades that have been in Western history?
Spanish Inquisition was a crusade.
Right. It was an inquisition against individuals. Correct. Good guys, bad guys. The ones on the inquisitors.
And justify that by saying God tells them to do it.
Right. Frequently, this perspective, the people who are crusaders have special message from God.
Well,
or claim that they have.
How about in England with the...
Cromwell.
Yeah. Well, the 30-year war in Germany.
30-year war in Germany between Catholics was a kind of crusade.
The Cold War.
Aztecs.
The Cold War had crusade-like qualities. Godless communism against Christian capitalism. You know, some people drew things in extreme fashion like that. Good.
Maybe in Ireland we have it now.
I think I've studied that one, the Presbyterian Church. I think that one's a little more complex than just calling it. Though there are crusade elements.
Yes.
Certainly, that's the thing today. One very seldom encounters the crusade in its kind of unvarnished form. That's why you can't find anyone who will very often articulate the crusade, but it runs as an undercurrent in social groups. We're the good guys and they're the bad guys. That dichotomy that we often set up in order to prepare ourselves to kill people, which is a nasty job if you haven't done it before.
Spanish going into the Aztec and Mexican.
Yes, a lot of,
well,
in us going into this continent, there was a crusade-like quality to the concept of manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. We decimated the Native Americans, both North and South America.
Yeah.
Perhaps the most famous, of course, yes.
Well, the Spaniards in Central America and Mexico, they felt perfectly justified in either if the Indians didn't want to become Christians, they felt it was their duty to kill them, it seems. It's not the way they proceeded.
Mm-hmm.
With the sword in one hand and the Bible in the other.
That's exactly right. And they saw the two very compatible. And they found the two very compatible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a crusading mentality. What are some of the problems with the crusading mentality?
You don't recognize your own sin.
Yes, when you divide things into good guys and bad guys, you fail to see your own sin. And you fail to see, in contrast, the good in the other person. You divide things into two. And if we follow our traditions carefully at this point, we know that each of us sins, both our enemies and ourselves. What else is problematic with the crusade?
The brutality of going out and killing will eventually make a brute out of the killers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And violence breeds violence, too. And by the way, the crusades are almost invariably the most horrendous and bloody of all wars. Why? Well, the restraints that morality put on, and particularly religious morality, are all removed when you have God commanding you to kill the evil people. All restraints are eliminated. And it's anything goes, and if you look at crusades, they're really nasty kind of events. And finally, I think the idea that God commands killing may be undertaken, perhaps, if you're a Christian realist, with some melancholy, but to see a perspective that where God commands that you wipe out people, men, women, and children, seems terribly incompatible with the model of Jesus that we get in the New Testament. For many reasons, while I can see both the first two perspectives, the crusade is one that I personally have a lot of problems with, and no longer consider a perspective that is Christian in nature because of the revelation, I think, of Jesus Christ, which is controlling, which really makes nonviolence primary.
They clean the Sikhs.
That's right. There is a crusade mentality going on among some of the various groups in India as well. We're doing it too to other peoples as well. In some ways, Vietnam was a crusade, part of the Cold War crusade that you mentioned.
The problem is in crusading, I'm thinking of the Cold War, the anti-communists and so forth, you tend to then stereotype. Everybody has to be, in your mind, either good guys or bad guys, everybody. And so then anybody who thinks unlike you in any way has to go on the other side.
Finally is the position perspective presented by Maria, which is one which we could call a liberation perspective. There are many versions of liberation perspective. She happens to represent one that is on the South American variety. And could you summarize what her perspective is?
Essentially that violence is being perpetrated on people in a systemic fashion, and that the oppressed and the poor are the victims of that violence, and so you need to essentially take power back in your own hands to change the systems.
Yeah, it's kind of a just war perspective, at least in the main, though it sometimes can have crusading qualities, but it says that violence is only justifiable in defense of oppressed peoples. That interstate violence between Western nations, for example, is not justifiable violence, but the only kind of violence is one that removes serious conditions of oppression. By the way, in liberation perspectives, there are pacifists who believe that liberation should be accomplished with only nonviolent means. For example, Martin Luther King Jr. would be a liberation perspective that was nonviolent. But there are types who would believe that when certain conditions of oppression are met, that a justifiable violence is called for, or there could be even crusaders who see the bringing in of the new era where the poor will be relieved of their suffering is a kind of crusade mentality, becomes a crusade mentality. But it's a variation, well, actually on all three, that's been present in the current era. All right, these are the three or four, and the three historical positions, and one fairly new one, which are the heritage of the Christian tradition. And provide guidance or a normative, a normal way of acting, and they're not at all in agreement. The tradition is of different voices. There are traditions, in other words, of guidance in Christianity. And my question to you now, and I'd like to sit back and listen to you, we've got almost a half hour, 35 minutes left, what should Martin say to his son? We haven't talked about the Vietnam War or about the draft particularly. Oh, one other thing I want to do first is, what is conscientious objection? This is one of the elements of the case. What's conscientious objection?
An objection which is led by the conscience.
Okay. And in this case, what is the objection?
To be violent. It
says that you are not allowed to be violent. Now, how does each of these perspectives, and what does the law say about conscientious objection? What would the pacifist be in terms of conscientious objection? What?
They agree.
Yes, that conscientious. And what is the law? Has the law in the past, and I think the law is still, the United States law is still consistent at this point. What does it say about COs, conscientious objectors?
They
They can do alternative service.
Yes, but...
It needs to be across the board.
Yeah, they have to be against violence in any form, and it has to be by religious... These are three tests. If you go before a draft board, if you're a young man, and you say you're a CO, and you go before your draft board, there's three tests. You have to be against all wars. You have to be there by reason of religious persuasion. So if you're a member of a peace church, you're automatically in. If you're a Lutheran or one of those in-between people, you got to make your case. And third,
an agnostic. I mean, that's one of the problems. Some of them are agnostic.
Yes. Well, at the end of the Vietnam War, they were allowing people with strong philosophical objections. And the third one is that you have to be sincere. And if you know what the draft boards at least used to be like, they used to be these crusty old veterans who were very skeptical about sincerity, particularly if all of a sudden you developed a conscientious objection just after the war started, you know. When I entered seminary in 1967, when the Vietnam War was building, all of a sudden the seminary population doubled from within a few years from 60 to 120. And the seminary thought, boy, we're doing things right now. You know why? And as soon as the war was over, boom, it went down to 60 or 70 because all ministerial students got 4D. That is, they were deferred while they were ministerial. And if they went on into the ministry, then they were exempt in perpetuity. So pacifists say for conscientious objection, and the law allows for a pure kind of conscientious objection. What if you're a Christian realist? How would you feel about conscientious objection?
Skeptical.
What?
Skeptical. Yeah.
I think it's more nuanced than that.
It would depend on the war.
Depend on the war. You'd have to be what's called a selective conscientious objector. You'd select your wars. Unfortunately, the law does not allow for selective conscientious objectors. So if Chris Paxton, the son, wants to be a selective conscientious objector, what does he have to do? If he's called, he signs up. Say he's called, what are his options then? If the war, in his opinion, is unjust. Or?
Canada.
You can go to jail, or go to Canada if you disagree with the war, but not all wars.
Right.
And for the crusader, of course, the conscientious objection is irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference to you because you're out there to join in and fight immediately. Now, those are all part of the mix about what Martin is going to say to Chris. Now, I'm going to shut up and I'm going to listen to you tell me what the father, or maybe in most of your cases, what did you say to your kids when they... or your children, maybe some of you didn't have boys, no children at all, in which case, what would you have said to your children when they faced the draft?
Well, I
yes?
I'd have to confess that I didn't say anything and let them join the Navy.
That's what happened to me. No one ever said anything. No one ever told me, I don't even know if I knew what a pacifist was. No one ever told me about. I just assumed it was my duty and went.
Later he was on the
and now I've come to question that, and question the society which did not raise these issues for me, so that I had a choice between perspectives. Yes?
I had a son in that situation, and I told him, basically, I thought if it was me, I'd go. But... it's his decision.
You mean in terms of Vietnam?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did he decide?
Fortunately, his number never got called. He didn't have to make the decision.
Uh-huh. So. Got lucky. 57,000 young men died in Vietnam.
Well, a lot of us were around for World War II. Mm-hmm. And that was a war where I had been, you know, wildly pacifist. And then, you know... non-interventionist and so forth at the beginning of that war, until finally I saw that it seemed to me that it was a just war, and so then, and in retrospect, it seems to me it was a just war. Whether it, you know, was or not, I don't know. But that then made it very confusing when the Vietnam War came along, because I had been in both mindsets.
Did you have occasion to advise a son?
I didn't, but I went on. I marched.
You marched?
Finally.
So you would have said to your son, don't go to that war?
I would have. He was blind in one eye, so it didn't matter. He wasn't going to be called.
But what you would have told him not to go, what would you have told him?
I would have let him make the decision. But my whole...
Would you have advised him, if he was a realist, to go to Canada or to submit to the legal process and go to jail?
I don't know.
All right.
I think the big problem is that we, the civilians, don't have enough information to make a value judgment on the purpose of the war or the justification for a war. I don't think we had much justification for Vietnam, if I can say that out loud. Truman thought we, wasn't he, got us into it?
Well, it's a long train of presidential decisions, yeah. Starting with Truman and going through Eisenhower.
And then we wouldn't quit till we killed everybody over there?
Tried to.
Genocide.
Well, that brings me to a more recent, I think it was Somali recently, where we used force. It wasn't a declared war as such, but the use of force to me there was questionable and not something that was necessarily in the public arena for debate. It happened without a lot of checks and balances, but it happened pretty quickly. And
our system.
One of the criteria was non-combatants not intentionally attacked. It was clear to me as soon as we brought in the helicopters in Somalia that there were going to be civilian casualties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a big criteria right there that I don't think we can, and your point about nuclear war, even, I mean, where do these criteria fit in a world where we're keeping a balance with nuclear arsenals?
The nuclear war does not fit several of the categories.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Christian realist, you have to raise serious questions about whether we should have nuclear weapons, or anybody should.
And you have Panama and Grenada, which we had nothing to say about.
Well, and Haiti coming up. Is this bad now that we need to rescue them, or is that something that's been built up?
One positive sign, I think, is that, and you know, there's always been a. Someone's trying to get my attention. I don't know what she's saying. There's always been a check and balance, that is to say that the Congress has to declare war and the President has to sign the declaration. So there's that attempt at a check and balances, which was escaped us in the Vietnam War because of the Tonkin Gulf incident. You remember that? And the Presidents thereafter took that as a kind of declaration of war that it wasn't, and used it to introduce all the troops, but we lost the checks and balances, which seem to be coming back. I think that the debate over the Gulf War in the Congress was one of the better debates that our country has had over whether to take violent action or not. Whether I agree or not with the what came out of that, I think it was a good debate over those issues.
Well, I think what's frustrating now is that we have the reputation of being a policeman to the world. I think the majority of us feel that we ought not to be in that role.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the hierarchy in our government keeps pushing us this way, and it's hard to understand why when so many of the people are very opposed to our invading Haiti or whatever the next step might be.
Mm-hmm.
Why they even discuss the matter? We should just bug out and stay out.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of people internationally are pushing us too to do this.
That's
a classical just war issue of whether the humanitarian needs of the slaughter of the Rwandans and the hunger of the Somalians, the suffering of the Haitian people over against a pretty nasty military leader.
But does the war make that any better? That's the point. We've done things in a so-called humanitarian way where what we think, and it never seems to pan out.
That would be your opinion, I take it, that we should not be that police, that we shouldn't provide that police function in the world.
No, I don't think so.
Theoretically, we seem to be promoting democracy as we see it. And, you know, maybe this is not what you think for them.
Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted us to be go over and find Serbia. Well, you know, that's a European problem as far as I'm concerned. They should be taking care of that problem themselves. It's not our business. And we've been involved in that probably a lot more than I think we should be. And I wish some of the other parts of the world would take care of their own problems and we butt out.
Yes.
There's another side in Haiti, though. They're in our backyard, so to speak, and we're having to take care of the refugees one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So, and we have a right to go in and stop it and try to fix things over there so they'll stay home or not. It's not clean cut.
Can we train the army that's now in control?
Well, the just war, most of you sound like you're just warriors, that there may be some conditions that you would send troops in. What conditions aren't met under the just war?
I'd like to have an aggressor where you're going against an aggressor.
Yeah, well, is the Haitian situation one where there's an aggressor?
No.
Well,
the aggression is in their own country.
Right? Should we? So does that meet the criteria of just cause? Oh, by the way, you only attack when in defense. You don't. Well, there can be a preemptive strike in some people's thinking. But.
Why don't we all work more for the United Nations?
That seems to be what Clinton's doing in this situation, at least visibly.
They seem to be happy to send troops here, there, and everywhere, as long as we're footing the bill and inviting most of them.
Right. No, this is the
say again.
The United Nations us footing the bill.
One of the helpful signs, I think, is to see the United States in recent years, and both Bush and Clinton administrations to seek the backing of the United Nations. Whether that's more show than reality, I'm not sure, because there's ways of manipulating people to do what you want to do on other grounds. But at least there's a check and balance of the police role that some people want to see us in.
One of the problems, it seems to me, is that with our great arms sales and our financial entering into, not the government, but private businesses entering into different countries and in a sense causing some of the problems that end up in the wars, but certainly the great number of arms that we're selling everywhere at this point is only making things in the future worse.
Of course, there's also maintained that selling arms helps even the battlefield somewhere else.
Yeah, that's what we'd like to say. You know, but I think we're selling them sort of indiscriminately.
Arms sales are huge.
Well, they will tell you that if we don't sell them, somebody else will be.
Oh, yes. So. Well, that's right.
Which is probably true.
What about the situation in Bosnia where we're withholding arms to one side?
Yeah.
And another one. Aggressions.
These are all modern efforts to try. Again, we've got to work out these principles on. I'm curious of getting back to the situation. What should Martin advise his son about signing up for the draft? If you were a young man, well, let's assume for the moment that the draft also includes women, which is an issue I'd like to come back to, whether women should be drafted as well as men. What would you do yourself?
Well, our boys signed up, but unfortunately they came along at a time when there was really enough going on. And I certainly would not advise them to defy the law of the land in terms of signing up. Now, beyond that, they would have to deal with their own.
What if they came to you on conscientious grounds and said that I cannot fight in a war? What would you respect that, or would you urge the same thing that you're urging
now?
No,
I would respect their feelings.
Okay.
On the other side,
I hope I would.
The other side of that is
say they live, what has happened to the conscientious objectors that have gone to Canada? Have they ever been able to come home?
What didn't Carter declare an amnesty?
And I don't say that you should go to war. I hated that war, but what kind of a life would they live?
What do you think about if you're a conscientious objector to a given war, not all wars, and you don't want to go to prison, is it moral for you to leave the country?
Or couldn't you register as a conscientious objector and then come back if you justified?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Go for the blanket statement, and then if you thought there was a justifiable war, get involved.
Oh, you can always say you're not a pacifist. The government doesn't mind that.
Register as a conscientious objector, and then choose your life.
Yeah, I don't think the government ever minds you going from pacifist to warrior.
Right.
What's worried about is going from warrior to pacifist. And if you are in the just war tradition and you are only are against certain wars and you were against Vietnam, is it moral? Did you think it was moral for those young men who left the country, Canada or other places, or should they have stayed home to take their medicine?
Good in prison than they would in Canada, except that once they did their prison term, they would be an American citizen again.
Mm-hmm.
A choice they'd have to make.
Mm-hmm.
I'm embarrassed to say this. I've lived in this country long enough, but do we not have an alternative? Like in Germany, the people that do not want to go, they do service for, I think, 2 years. They work with the Red Cross, they're not just out of it. They're not excused. They do something else. Some were helping people.
Right now we have no draft. It's only the form of it's there. The setup, the apparatus. No one's being drafted at this point. In other times, when we did have a draft, the only reason you would be exempt and could do alternative service were if you were a conscientious objector to all wars.
We don't, in the States, there really is not such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember talking, a lot of my friends' sons did that.
Mm-hmm.
And they all were doing something. And some of it was stuff they would rather not have done.
That's right.
But it was not being a soldier.
No, we never have instituted a kind of universal service law in this country.
Well, that's because in Germany itself, military service is mandatory even without a draft.
Or you can do the social service.
Right, but a 2-year commitment.
The 2-year commitment, a kind of universal social service, be it military or otherwise, is the German situation. It's not here in this country. It never has been.
If Germany were to go to war, would that be the same thing? Was
yes.
World War II, did you have a choice at World
no.
War II, or were you in the army?
Under Hitler, you probably did not have a choice.
That's a post-war phenomenon.
Yes.
Now, what do you think about? Do you think if a young man in this country objects to a specific war and there's no provision that he should suffer the penalty of going to prison?
No.
Or should he leave?
No.
I think he should leave.
Should he be allowed back?
No.
Well, now, there were some in the Army, maybe other services as well, who served in uniform, but and on the front, but they didn't carry weapons. They were medics and that sort of
chaplain's assistants.
And chaplain's assistants, yes. In fact, I think. I'm not sure what status. I guess that was more or less mind of the CO. He'll say, "Yes, I am a CO, but I will serve, just not in."
That was, again, that's one of the forms of alternative service that was allowed to CO.
Okay, so it's
not. Well, when probably half of an army is non-combatant anyway, it seems to me there are many, many places that somebody who objected to fighting could serve very nicely without getting into combat, and you know, they're resilient. You can be cooks.
That's right.
All kinds of things.
Of course, cooks were trained to kill. They were considered combatants. No, they were given military training and were expected to throw down their spoons and pick up their rifles. beat their spoons and swords, you know.
But if you were a Christian realist and you believed in the war in general,
that there are just wars,
and so you were drafted and you were serving, and then you saw that what your commanders were doing was something that was, I mean, the melee type thing, where they were killing innocent people unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Then what's your course? I mean, that's...
Well, you don't have many good alternatives, I'll tell you that much.
Shoot or be shot.
Well, very seldom is it the extremity of being shot, but you'll be court-martialed and put in prison, just like someone.
Mm-hmm.
And you know why the military insists on this, don't you?
Yeah, well, they have to be able to come.
I mean, you can't have a bunch of soldiers who you're marching into battle and half of them say, I don't like this war. It makes for a very bad military organization.
Maybe a good one. I mean, maybe that would make us double think which involvements that you would need.
That could be.
If you had an army that was convinced of the cause, it would probably be a very short war.
Often armies that aren't convinced of their cause make very poor armies anyway. That's
when
true.
They're taking this test to be a conscientious objector, and I relate to World War II, how would they pinpoint and taking sincerity into the consideration that person isn't going to like any war, any kind of war, ever?
If you were a member of a peace church, that automatically lets you in. Otherwise, it was the judgment of a three-man board, and they voted.
But a person, I mean, under those circumstances, a young man could say with all sincerity and be totally sincere on it that he was against war, because the only war he has in mind is this thing that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would do his alternative service. So I wonder how they pinpoint between the conscientious objector that has to go to Canada and the one that does alternative service.
Well, that's not the issue. The issue is, how do they judge the sincerity of the person? Is the person being a pacifist because he doesn't want to get shot? You know, he's afraid, or he's just trying to get out of the war and let someone else get killed instead of him? Or does the person have actually sincere convictions? And again, the criteria were, if you're a member of a peace church in the Vietnam War, and later a long paper trail. Do you know what that means?
Yes.
That is, and that's what I certainly, if you have children or grandchildren which are conscientious objectors, having a paper trail, that is a long number of statements of people testifying to your pacifism, you better collect that about the same time you sign up, or as soon as you figure out that you're a pacifist. Because the draft board's more likely to find sincerity in a 2 or 3 year commitment than a 6 day commitment. I mean, that I would too if I were making that judgment. But basically, the draft boards would judge that anyway, same way you would judge it. Yeah.
But overall, we do insist on the principle that we must act not contrary to conscience, correct?
I think the tradition is quite clear on that. You have a duty to government, but you have a higher duty to God. And if God, your relationship with God and your conscience, you feel you have to be nonviolent, that takes precedence. Right. I think that principle's...
And suffer the consequences.
Not all Christians agree with that. They take that passage about rendering unto Caesar and the passage in Paul about obeying the governing authorities, Romans 13, verse 7, 1 to 7, and see that as being a mandate for service to your country, whether it's right or wrong. There are Christians who believe that. But I think that the higher allegiance is the one, as someone who's thought about this a little bit, that's my opinion.
You joined the Navy.
Yeah, we just discovered there's two of us here, and we were in the Vietnam at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Really? And were you what kind of...
This is my case. This is myself and my son.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah, this is what happened.
So you had that...
And I wrote it to try to advise him on what he should do. Is that you really, as a person, you should advise your children on the option. Well, and make clear your own perspective.
You can advise them, but their personal conscience tells them what to do, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that's the right answer. If there is an answer in this case, that you give them the options and tell them your own opinion, and then it's their duty to make up their own mind. You can't, and if they don't do what you say to do, that's their own...
Between them and God.
Yes, exactly right.
I think your point about peace education lacking is a good one. I mean, there is very little of it.
I've got a lecture here on my own thinking about the Vietnam War. One of the things that's very prominent in that is the lament that, again, that I was not trained, and then I ended up killing in Vietnam without having thought about what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I hadn't even thought about it.